like any vocation, to be a consecrated virgin or a hermit or a Jesuit or a sister of charity, a daughter of charity, ultimately traces its root to the divine impulse, you know, to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the church is sort of the custodian of God's gifts and helps consecrate people who feel this impulse to live it in syntony with the gospel and with the Catholic tradition. So to say that a hermit is a member of the consecrated life, yes, I think that, you know, that stretches it a bit. What is difficult in that case to always to understand is the community dimension, because a hermit, by definition,
is someone who pulls himself away from society.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, but we do, these are ancient vocations in the church. I mean, the vocation to hermit. In fact, St. Anthony began his life as a hermit, as someone who lived apart. He sold all that he had and provided for his younger sister, which was good of him, and then went out into the desert of Egypt. And there were other people who sort of felt drawn to, by the example of his life, to accompany him. And so the hermit was no longer a hermit. Instead, he had a community of men around him that were, and then later women, who followed his example.
Now, it was Pope John Paul II who instituted the World Day for Consecrated Life back in 1997. In his homily for the very first celebration on February 2nd that year, he said, "The observance is intended to help the entire church to esteem ever more greatly the witness of those persons who have chosen to follow Christ by means of the practice of the evangelical councils, and at the same time is intended to be a suitable occasion for consecrated persons to renew their commitment and rekindle the fervor which should inspire their offering of themselves to the Lord." Now here we are, 2011, that's some 14 years later, in a very changed world. How do you think Pope Benedict sees this World Day for Consecrated Life?
Well, I think he appreciates the inspiration of his predecessor. Pope Benedict will be with members of the Consecrated Life on February 2nd to celebrate evening prayer in the Basilica of St. Peter's. And he'll give a homily to the members there that I'm sure will be later communicated around the world. I think that it's important to look at the original inspiration of Pope John Paul II, that this was not simply for consecrated people, but it's for the church. And it's to remind the church of the presence of this particular vocation, which he judged himself. I think if you read some of his own writing, especially the apostolic exhortation Vita Consecrata, that he saw it as something quite important and one would even say essential for the church's life. So I think the celebration of February the 2nd was first and foremost for the church, to remind the faithful of the beauty, the importance of this vocation.
Now, Pope Benedict himself has likened consecrated life to a plant with many branches, which sinks its roots into the gospel and brings forth abundant fruit in every season of the church's life. But he's also called consecrated men and women a bridge to God for all those he or she meet, a call and a return. What is the Pope, do you think, expecting of the faithful here and the consecrated?
Well, I think that of the consecrated life, I mean, I like his example of a plant. I mean, I often speak of it, of the consecrated life as a whole, because in my service to the church, I deal with all a variety of forms of consecrated life, from monks to teaching religious, to missionaries, to people who live a contemplative or life that is in some way separated from the world. I think of, taken together, it is a sort of ecosystem. And like the Amazonian rainforest, it's essential to the larger system of the church. Without that rainforest, we would find it very difficult to breathe, because it provides oxygen for the world. And I think in some way the consecrated life should provide this oxygen for the church. Part of it, in drawing on that second, about the bridge example, is to illustrate the importance of God before all else. Because I think if you want to find the common denominator among religious, it's that. I mean, that whatever their particular work may be or their service, pastoral service, it's first and foremost a recognition of the supremacy of God, and that everything that we are is conditioned by that. And so that perhaps the freedom, the joy, the hope that we religious find in pursuing our vocation and in recognition of the supremacy of God will also help married couples, single people, young people find joy and freedom and really the correct direction in their own lives.
You know, Pope Benedict also pointed in some of his discourses to cloistered communities as being united to Christ's passion. And this is just one quote from Pope Benedict, taking on themselves the sufferings and trials of others and offering everything with joy for the salvation of the world. But in today's age of 3-second sound bites, iPhones, YouTube, Twitter, some might think that cloisters or these cloistered communities would be passé. Are they?
Well, I don't think so, and I think most of the brothers and sisters that I know that live that particular lifestyle wouldn't think so, and especially the younger members that are attracted by the, I suppose, the depth that one finds in a cloister. Now, the depth is a recognition that reality isn't simply a superficial or passing fad.
I think, and also this Pope reminded us of the importance of silence in our lives. In this world, it is so noisy. So we're bombarded with so many images and sounds. The importance of silence.
I think you're right. And he reminds us in very practical ways, like his own practice and really expectation that other celebrants follow the practice of, after the gospel, of just being quiet for a moment, you know, to allow the word of God to resonate and speak within us. We are surrounded by a lot of words. And I remember once reading in a manual of management that said, formerly, a practice was to withhold information so you could guarantee your importance in a structure. Now it's simply to bombard people with words, and then no one really knows what's important or not. And I think that silence can help us understand and witness to the one thing necessary.
Now, people were shocked by the clerical abuse, sex abuse crisis, and revelations that the leader of at least one institute for religious life had seriously compromised his vows and the trust of his followers. And here I'm thinking in particular of the Legionaries of Christ. The faithful and many young seminarians and priests have felt, quite frankly, betrayed by those who they once trusted. To what extent have these scandals taken a toll, do you think, on vocations in the church? And do you think enough has been done to purge this behavior from the church and ensure that it never happens again?
Well, there are several questions there. I mean, the first regards scandal. And, you know, Jesus was very, very, used very strong language about scandal, because I think he knew in his compassionate heart just what damage can be done. The people of this city recognized it millennia ago when they had a proverb that said, corruptio optima pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. And that's exactly true, because it leaves people cynical or dubious regarding the authenticity of anybody who tries to do good things. Now, I think in that sense, religious and priests across the world, in my experience, have been touched and hurt by the scandals such as the one you just touched upon, because all of us feel a bit suspect, you know. I've also found that if people know us, and they eventually will form their own judgment about whether we're the real deal or not. And I think that the church, both locally and universally, is making serious efforts and progress to ensure that, to the best we can, that scandals don't occur. I don't think we can give 100% guarantee, because finally people are free, and they're free to choose very evil things. It's my belief, and I'm by nature an optimist, that people don't go out of their way to choose evil. And however, I do believe that religious leaders have a special responsibility to offer a witness that's transparent in all senses of the word. And when we don't do that, the price is very severe. Now, I'm glad to see that, you know, I can speak, for example, of some dioceses in the United States. I understand where there were some very public and damaging scandals, that the vocations to the diocesan priesthood and some religious institutes has not disappeared. I mean, in fact, it's recovered and seems to be going well. But that's not, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that, I think that some very severe wounds have been inflicted on the church. And I think the Holy Father is one of the first to recognize that.
And you there at the congregation, are you able to offer any kind of practical support for people, for example, as these seminarians and the legionaries, you know, who've suffered this trauma? Are you able to offer any kind of spiritual, practical support?
Well, I think, you know, if you're speaking about the specific case of the legionaries, the Holy Father has, you know, reached out and both in responsibility to correct the errors, that the sin, the evil that has been unleashed, but also to care for the people who have been crushed and wounded by the evil choices of people they respected in authority. So the Holy Father has provided, you know, a group of cardinals and that are accompanying the legion led by Cardinal de Paulus. For ourselves, we deal sometimes with particular cases of members of a religious order that find themselves in crisis, trying to find a solution that's consistent with the values of the gospel and the church's tradition. We also try to take preventative measures in the sense that when we look at the state of a religious order, you know, its own self-examination, we pay special attention to the formation that's being given to enter the selection of candidates and to ensure that the beauty of that particular vocation is reflected in the care with which candidates are admitted and later formed.
Pope John Paul II suggested that consecrated people not only, and these are his words, have a glorious history to remember and to recount, but also a great history still to be accomplished. He said, look to the future where the Spirit is sending you in order to do even greater things. And Pope Benedict, too, is urging people, it seems to me, to rekindle the enthusiasm for the faith that the first Christian communities enjoyed. And this in a world today where religion is more and more seen as a source of conflict or of division. From here, then, what future for consecrated life?
Well, I you won't be surprised if I tell you that I agree with both pontiffs there. I think the words of Pope John Paul that you quoted to conclude Vita Consecrata are a very salutary reminder to religious who, at times, looking at the limited horizon of this moment in history, may feel very discouraged. And I think they're with reason in some contexts. What are the reasons for hope? Well, I think the reasons for hope is that this, finally, religious life or consecrated life isn't simply a human project. It isn't that the founders like St. Ignatius Loyola or St. Francis de Sales or Dominic or Jean-François de Chantel, or any of them sat down and said, you know, I think it's a good idea to found a religious order. It was the impulse of God. It was the work of God in giving a gift to the church. And that's what charism finally means. It's a gift. So to conclude the consecrated life is over, I mean, you'd have to say, well, then God chooses not to give gifts to the church any longer. I mean, this is a gift among other gifts. And so, yes, and I think there are very practical possibilities for the service of the consecrated life to the church and to the world. For example, you mentioned about the marginalization of religion and the growth of division. Well, consecrated life is a reality that goes beyond national borders. I mean, many of the really thriving religious orders and congregations today are multinational groups, multicultural groups. And they're groups that, in my mind, prolong the miracle of Pentecost. Not simply that the good news is heard in all, you know, in everybody's language, but that the good news doesn't require people to forfeit the richness of their own tradition or their culture. And so while it's not always easy, I think at our best, we reflect a Catholic Church in a microcosm. That religious order or religious congregation, while very attentive to the local circumstances, is a reality that also witnesses to the God who loves and enters all of human reality.